How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening! You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 9, Episode 22. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of author Dan Cardoza, about fearsome flights, careless crooks, dangerous delusions, and noxious neighbors. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. There are some who've seen the love of their life disappear, settling far away. Some of them go on a trip, ill-advised or otherwise, to get them back. But Morrison's hunt for his ex-wife, leading him away from his 12-step recovery program and onto a plane to Nebraska in our first Dan Cardoza story of the evening, may be just the wrong thing to do. But not necessarily for the reasons he might think. Without further ado, I present to you Frontier Flight 167. No one in the support group thought recovery would be easy. But Morrison couldn't even get past step one. I admit I'm powerless over alcohol and drugs, and my life has become unmanageable. Unlike most in the group, no one hadn't been court-ordered to attend. In that situation, hope was a dim spark in the otherwise bleak darkness of the landscape. Morrison had committed petty crimes, but mostly against himself. A kind judge had ratcheted up Morrison's punishment in an attempt to save his life. He'd referred to it as tough love. Group therapy was part of the healing process. But a scab is a scab, and mostly worth scarring over. He knew he could outsmart everyone, including himself. That's one of the reasons he quit the group. I can quit anything I need to on my own. After all, I've done it many times before. He was smarter than most, more clever, the best, someone who'd never met his most elementary objectives. When you can blame the ills of your life on others, there's never a reason to commit to success. Success was for others, the sheep of the world. Playing things safe wasn't in Morrison's makeup. And so, Morrison committed to make another blunder. If he failed, well, he could always blame it on someone else. Excuses were something he kept handy, like zigzag, slow-burning smoke paper. He'd left his ankle monitor back at the apartment, in bed with the flu. Morrison purchased a one-way ticket to surprise his ex. She feared for her life and had moved back home to Omaha, Nebraska, near a family who barely cared for her because of how much she'd hurt them. It was in Omaha where she'd at least have half a chance to engage in her personal struggle and maybe get well. She had no one left to turn to except family, nowhere else to make a fresh start. Marcy thought of her family as cod liver oil, but she'd considered them her last choice of medicine. She'd taken a detour in life, the one that reads, "What doesn't kill you has the potential to make you stronger." Like most things in life, Morrison hatched his half of his half-assed plan to win back Marcy. Hell, he had lots of plans. It's not that he wasn't intelligent. He'd blown the Stanford Binet IQ test out of the water. The psychologist in college had said he was like a brand new red Ferrari, but without any wheels. "One of your problems, Morrison, is that you have a big cowboy hat and no cattle." Morrison had come close to punching the shrink out. He had plenty of time to workshop his idea before he landed in Omaha. First, he had to figure out how to explain his surprise arrival. He'd always been quick on his feet to get Marcy back. He'd done it so many times before. But this time, the stakes had been raised. It was life or death for both of them. Marcy knew very well that they were never going to work. It was just Morrison that hadn't gotten the memo. Marcy was the fortunate one. She'd already said her final goodbyes to survive. And this time, she meant it. She'll understand. She's always given in before. She's weak-willed. Morrison mumbled to himself under his headphones. He's grown accustomed to seeing her as hapless and helpless, just where he'd wanted her. Upon his arrival in Omaha, he made sure the first thing she heard was, "I really changed, honey. I promise." He'd convince her to love him again. Maybe she didn't mean it when she said, "I'll die if I don't go. It's either you, Morrison, or me who's going over the cliff." But Morrison was a narcissist. If anyone was going over the cliff, it wouldn't be him. But in truth, Morrison hadn't thought that far ahead. He was jittery and pensive. Morrison's foot itched. He scratched it. The twitch in his right eye hadn't quit. The cocaine in his pocket was calling him a little bitch. And this goddamn craving he needed to calm the hell down. To steel his nerves, a couple of lines seemed in order. To Morrison, breaking the rules was normal. Laws and rules were for the riffraff in life. Only the crazy and the strongest survive. Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Alexander the Great. Compassion and empathy were crutches for cowards. The aircraft lavatory in the rear of the airplane was the only place to catch blow. It was in there he'd get his thoughts on straight and scheme the rest of his impulsive plan. His flight was going to last a little over an hour, after all. He'd have time to think in the tiny, claustrophobic room. Morrison had some explaining to do. Once he'd manipulated Marcy into returning with him, the two of them would need to return in a hurry. He had an ankle monitor that needed hot chicken soup. Maybe Marcy's creepy parents would pay for their return flight. Morrison would figure it out once he had his black boots on the ground. After passenger 23D exited the head at the stern, it was Morrison's turn. At 30,000 feet on his thinking stool, he remembered Omaha, Nebraska. Omaha, where they'd met poor, he and Marcy. It was in grade school, each a farm child. They had litters of brothers and sisters. Each farm, their respective daddies worked, had been a new beginning, a beginning of the next failure. The only things the farms really grew were leveraged loans, witchweed, broken equipment, dead cows. Oh, and lest one forget, poverty of crops and spirit. Morrison recalled his family as a pack of miserable, mangy coyotes. He visualized his youth in his dizzy head. It was a forced labor camp under the supervision of his oppressive, homemade wine-guzzling father and their defeated mother. When he left Nebraska for good, it was in desperation. He'd left toward an unknown future, any future, really. He chewed off a foot to get out of the family's varmint trap. Morrison was okay with that. Being the walking wounded would draw sympathy. At least he'd set himself free. Marcy, who left with him, thought he could be fixed, maybe like a cheap watch. Over time, she turned into a sob before it would turn into mutual positioning. During the last 6 months, Morrison's self-esteem had been cut into pieces. Everything he did in life seemed to come up short. There was part of him that made certain of that. Each cut of failure had turned into a colloid scar of denial, a hypertrophic healing as thick as any meth line he'd shaved with, a bad credit card. He had his reasons not to look deep inside. It was too painful. Inside was where failure had been incubating. Morrison stood and bent over. He used a dollar bill to straighten out the white lines. He rolled it into the E pluribus unum straw. Morrison snorted, first left, then right. Morrison sat back down on the rim of the bowl. His head nearly exploded. Morrison clenched his teeth while sitting on the toilet. He recalled his most recent nightmare, only this one was real. He hoped the dark thoughts would scare him straight somehow. Ah, hell nah. There's always a tomorrow. He mumbled to no one except the thrumming sound of the airplane. Bathroom. All the hissing. He fastened on his defiant, best smirk. It was then he heard the faint rapping at the door. The police voice of the Midwestern flight attendant. Everything okay in there, sir? Morrison recognized the regional dialect. How could he ever forget? Her voice was as sweet as unsalted dairy butter. Yes, he shouted over the whines of engines and speed. He hasn't felt this relieved and relaxed since the last time he'd broken the law. The aircraft had finally reached 30,000 feet. That moment, up here, everything was possible. To hell with tomorrow, he hollered. The knocking got louder. Just a damn minute, he said. The whole damn world could wait on him. Morrison's lighter slipped out of his hand. He missed his hip pocket. He turned himself into a pretzel and telescoped his long arm and hand down to the floor to grab it. He smelled piss. He paused. Something had caught his attention. Morrison exploded from behind the lavatory door. The door's edge was a dull knife. The fresh, out-of-training flight attendant buckled to her knees. After, she fell sideways on the low-cropped, carpeted floor. Morrison turned away from her to his right. He quickly headed down the tired, dark aisle with tracking lights on the floor. As he quickened, he reached out, hooking his flailing arms at strangers. He attempted to yank the sticky flesh out of their cloth crab shells. Passengers woke, thinking they were in a miserable nightmare. Some clawed back at Morrison, imagining him all pincers and bite. Nearly everyone panicked. Morrison's throat had parched raw. The only noise to escape his pie hole was a crepe paper flitting sound. When he inhaled, the sound was paper catching fire. Everything he'd ever know was about to come to an end. Layla, the dazed flight attendant, forced herself up off her ass. A few of the passengers at the back of the plane had gasped in dread and disbelief as they gazed into her eyes. Layla was bleeding from her nose and mouth. There was a fresh cut from the bathroom door edge. Crimson oozed bright red from her left cheekbone. Her training instincts kicked in. She grasped the handheld microphone after they helped her stand up. Just as she'd been taught, she shouted, "Squawk, 7600! Squawk, 7600!" That's an internal aircraft code that means the plane has lost communication with the tower. She was, of course, incorrect. She made her first mistake hardly anyone had noticed. It was then the aircraft hiccuped and dropped 10 feet. It jerked the passengers out of their seat. The pilot's knee had jerked this hard during his last annual neurological exam. Like how reflexes go spastic after being hit in the crazy bone, or the kneecap with one of those Dr. Flintstone rubber hatchets. Layla was quick to self-correct. "Jim Wilson," she quipped. "Jim Wilson, aft," she quipped again. Unfortunately, that was the cool kid's code for dead bodies in the cargo hold, yet another rookie mistake. The aircraft jiggled and shook a tad. Passenger 23C was all Cheshire. He was a seasoned flight attendant. Donnie Chamberlain was making his way back to Omaha for a surprise birthday party he'd already known about. Halfway down the aisle, two Hereford cattle bulls wrestled Morrison's grip away from the emergency door handle. They slammed him to the floor, bloodied his lips. "Jesus, that was close," said Sumo Wrestler One. Both of the hulking sumos could taste the acidity of fear at the back of their throats. In his fall to the ground, Morrison lost most of the air in his stomach. The only sound to escape his lungs was a bleeding sound, not unlike the sound of a sacrificial goat making before the slaughter. A retired peacenik hippie, who'd been stretching his blood-clot legs, had filled his eyes with too much watching. He couldn't control his rusty, protesting tongue. He blurted out, "He's crazy as hell and crawling in meth." His wife tugged at his blue floral shirt until he plopped down beside her again. The floor of the aisle was a tipped barrel of eels. Morrison wriggled free somehow. Passenger 23C kicked at him as if Morrison was a cur dog, but missed. The next thing they knew, Morrison was at the captain's door, pounding and clacking at the door's thin latch. Thankfully, the FAA had made sure the door was locked as tight as a frog's ass underwear. The second flight attendant, in with the pilots, pushed back at the aircraft pilot's door as if she was saving the world. Morrison cracked his now bloody knuckles against the metal door. He pulled at a flimsy locked handle. In the pilot's galley, Texas Marla hung onto the doorknob as if she was riding Red Rock, the famous bucking bull she'd seen at the Folsom Rodeo. "Giddy up, cowgirl," the co-pilot had told her. It wasn't long before the brewing witch mob forced Morrison into one of the empty first-class seats. Someone passed a roll of black Gorilla duct tape along to the sumos. It was like they'd taken a course in applying a straitjacket. They wrapped the sticky tape around and around his flailing torso and the tall back seat. Passenger 23C and 23D exchanged flash drives. 23C pecked at the iPad's keyboard. Layla, who'd composed herself, managed to hip-bang her way to the front of the aircraft, exactly as she'd been instructed. She was taking charge now, goddammit. Her new feelings felt more natural, something she hadn't been taught. She grabbed the mic again. This time, the loudspeaker code was at least half-assed correct. She yelled from someplace deep in her gut. It was visceral and violent. Possible 7,500 in progress. 7,500 in progress. Hearing the rookie flight attendant, the pilots knew for sure that there was a hijacking in progress. The co-pilot pissed his pants and stared into the glassy darkness in front of him. Finally, getting it right, Layla slipped Morrison the slender needle. It entered his left shoulder as smooth as silk stainless steel. The jacked-up liquid began to infuse him with all the calming goodness the almighty FAA allowed. Antihistamine at 50 milligrams, single dose equivalent. By God, the antihistamine would act as a tranquilizer and calm the crazy bastard down. Layla couldn't wait to surprise her parents with her heroism. They were waiting for her at Epley Field in Omaha, too. Her daddy was paying too much for an airport hamburger at the time. They'd be so damn proud of her. Thankfully, Morrison, at last, appeared calm, but that was only because Sumo Number 2 had knocked him out a few minutes ago. Layla, triumphant and exhausted, flopped into an empty first-class seat, the closest. She fully reclined the seat. To hell with decorum and protocol. She earned a break. After all, she'd just saved this screwed-up world. The medication Morrison had been injected with had the opposite effect on him. Instead of calming him down, it jacked up his heart rate. As his heart jetted, he began to rock back and forth in his duct-tape cocoon. It had become a chrysalis. He wanted free. His thoughts were a synapse insane asylum. The veins in his neck appeared blue and swollen as they pulsed. Morrison began shaking in his seat as if he was attempting to break some sort of speed barrier. Tears rolled down his cheeks as clear as nitroglycerin. He couldn't stop trembling, his rattlesnakes rattling. He became speechless, his mouth full of fear. In the back of the aircraft, next to the ticking toilet door, an empty injection vial rolled gently to and fro on the blue carpet. It was so empty it appeared to float as the plane yanked down again. The Lilliputian label seemed to vibrate. It read, epinephrine, 1/10,000th, single dose, 2 milliliter equivalent. Layla made her final mistake. She'd been taking her last break ever. Morrison's eyes grew explosive. At Mach 4, in his mind, he could hear everything, including the pitch and yaw of the aircraft, the rolling vial at the back near the head. His eyes popped out of their sockets as he recalled what he'd seen taped under the lavatory cabinet. Morrison shrieked at last. "Bomb! Bomb!" he yelled at the top of his lungs. The metrics of Planck quantum physics, digital words blazed across what was Morrison's gray matter. In his darkness, he stared into this bright yellow neon signage. This massive quote looped across the intersection of his psychic marquee. The unforgettable quote was from the novel Zeitun, written by Dave Eggers. Yes, a dark time passed over this land, but now there's something like light. Morrison knew this as a reference to surrender and redemption, a quote often used by Morrison's group therapist. Then, and only then, you could hear a pin drop as the top of Morrison's skull blew off. Someone or something over the dark skies of Omaha, Nebraska, had switched the lights on. The sky had turned unmanageably bright. I hope you enjoyed Frontier Flight 167 by author Dan Cardoza, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that first tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Cardoza. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/CARDOZA. You may remember Dan from a few tales from earlier this summer. If not, take this opportunity to find out more about how he knows what can make you tick. If you decide to stop by the profile, please leave Dan a kind word and let him know you heard about him here on this show and that Otis Gyrie sent you. It would mean a lot to me and to Dan. Thanks for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. I've been on a few flights when people go screaming out of the bathrooms, screaming about bombs, but usually they're just referring to the in-flight movie. Sometimes family isn't quite so far away. In our second Dan Cardoza tale, foster system Charlie knows exactly where his negligent father keeps all the copper in his junkyard. Too bad their relationship isn't on more. Well, solid footing, as it were. Without further ado, I present to you Stealing Love. Young Charlie Tillman was a mouse in a trap. He thought the trap was a practical joke that he was playing on himself. It felt unreal the way he kept track of time. He'd been reduced to measuring the levels of darkness in spoonfuls as it sifted through the cracks in the trunk. On day 5, he lay motionless, fetus in need. He readied himself to die. His fingers had been bloodied, moist from the scratching and clawing of metal in a desperate attempt at freedom. He enjoyed sucking the tips of each finger, if only to remind him of what it felt like to quench his thirst. But that was all gone now. The blood had dried, exposing the ivory dullness of Charlie's distal phalanges. Charlie aced freshman year biology without cracking a single book. But he was beyond biology now. He could feel himself slipping away. Death was imminent. It would summon him in a few hours, or so he thought. Charlie Tillman was born sour, beyond his expiration date. The obstetrician told his father, Bernie, "Sir, he's defective." "Is it something I can discard?" his father asked politely. His son had been diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. He'd killed his mother on his birthday. She died during a malpractice C-section. Charlie would grow up knowing little about his mother, other than her name was Rose. His alcoholic father, Bernie, had given Charlie up for adoption before he was 6 months old. "It's too stressful to raise the boy on my own," he said to the church's social worker. In truth, Charlie's old man loved to party hardy and did volumes of methamphetamines. And, of course, Bernie had all that malpractice insurance money to burn through before he got on with his life. Since no one owed Charlie a thing, he was never adopted. The most desperate of infertile couples couldn't get past the difficult diagnosis. And so, at the age of 2, Charlie was placed on the foster care system conveyor belt. If he were white bread, he would have gotten moldy. He wasn't claimed by anyone until he was around 3 years of age. "Welcome, Charlie lad. Ye be but a bitcoin on this merry-go-round of want and need." I'm sorry if my voice sounds a little grave. The heat and the eternity do that to you. Charlie made it through his first full year residing in this hellhole known as North Sacramento, a place where even the cats fight more. He'd been abused and, worse, neglected. Children's Protective Services stepped in to rectify the situation. After a thorough evaluation, the CPS sold Charlie to yet another miserable living arrangement. Before he'd reached the age of 13, Charlie lived in a total of 7 foster care homes, if double-wides count. Imagine that, listener, being assigned to a family. Assigned. As a young boy, Charlie and a few of his buddies often hitched rides on the first freight train heading east out of the city of Ranch Cordova. Some days they skipped school together and kicked around the countryside. Their favorite train ride was way out to this knot in the road called Slough House. The small town of Slough House was just to the right of this gunmetal cantilever bridge with lots of graffiti. The riveted bridge spanned the Cosumnes River, sometimes mud, other times torrent. As summer approached, they'd swim in the deepest holes. How deep they'd dive depended on the spring runoff from the Sierra Nevada mountains. Freezing, they'd warm their naked asses, one of the large number of granite boulders that littered the banks of their favorite river. Diving off the Slough House Bridge was their favorite, though. The boys would prevail at getting warned year after year by the sheriff's office. Diving was illegal, but they'd done it, too, when they were boys. Hitchhiking back to town meant exchanging their bitter faces for choir boy looks and how much they could engage in a decent conversation with the type of man who wanted to get to know them better. Absent a ride, they'd follow the usual mirage, a mirage that was always there with them unless there wasn't any sunshine. The phantasm insisted on misting over the railroad tracks like a river. They'd wade through its waters, though 5 or 6 miles back to their homes. For Charlie, arriving late never meant extra punishment. There were always plenty of leftovers. The sum total of all the punishment was worth a good day outdoors. Charlie couldn't get enough of the taste of freedom. Like most human kids that have been rejected, the streets finish raising you. Maybe he'd completed the 8th or 9th grade, maybe not. That's when Charlie ran away from his last placement. Do it, Charlie boy, or else I'm going to make you kill someone. This delicious voice had shouted into the mush of gray matter that was our Charlie's mind. When you feel so messed up inside, it's too difficult to think about education or bettering yourself. Run, run, run away is what you tell yourself. And so Charlie roamed. No matter where he landed, those that remembered him only spoke of his kindness and compassion for the trials of humans. Charlie was pushing nearly 6 feet in height when he bolted. If you could see through the cornflower hair that covered his eyes were still water blue and deep. Charlie had an athletic build and was as quick on his feet like a cat. He was a soulful character, having no regrets about his past. His sense of wonder and excitement about the world was contagious. Charlie had few possessions as he grew older, but whatever he had, he shared. Making poor decisions had never distracted him from being a good young man. Charlie had turned 24 a few months back. He called two places home, down by the Consumnes River, or under the Highway 50 overpass in the winter, the one that contoured and stretched over the top of the Shell Quick Mart gas station. Both places had something to do with drinking wine or using drugs. On the street, self-medication is the common denominator that assigns you friends and homes. Lifting copper wire and thieving aluminum had become Charlie's forte. In fact, you could mostly find Charlie down at Rudy's Metal on Richards Boulevard in North Sacramento. Selling metals at Rudy's was easy. No questions asked. Quick cash. The only thing Charlie kept in his jeans pocket was a few burning holes and a sharp knife. He'd spend or give away most of the money he earned. He used the blade to strip electrical conduit he'd stolen. The Home Depot, Ace Hardware, construction sites, demolition grounds, and abandoned homes. Charlie began to steal copper wiring from construction sites. He'd turned his stealth into an art, yet he only stole enough to self-medicate and survive. Taking care of his immediate needs and attempting to fill that moon-cratered hole in his gut was a full-time job. Old softy me, I admired something in that young man. Most of the wire he collected was number 12 or 14 gauge. Copper wire that's been approved by California's electrical code. Lights, switches, washers, dryers, pumps, and toasters. If Charlie was really lucky, he might discover the occasional number 10 gauge wire. Stripped down, bare, 4 to 6 gauge copper wire was the gold standard, but rarely accessible. Hopping the tracks to get in and out of our town allowed Charlie an opportunity to access the back ends of junkyards, recycling centers, and excess inventory yards of electrical contractors. It was better than cruising Amazon, eBay, or QVC, the home shopping network. Charlie had learned from the best how to scale barbed wire fencing. It was more art than science. It was more than an old coat laid over the top of rows of barbed wire. Vicious dogs never mattered. At Bernie's Junkyard Dog, the recycling business Bernie had gotten off the ground from his dead wife's life insurance and malpractice lawsuit, Bernie had gotten rich over the years. Over time, his small recycling center employed a few junkyard workers, and Bernie hadn't decided on a night shift yet. Until recently, there'd been no guard dogs. Charlie loved him some guard dogs. Unconditional love is an aphrodisiac. A few weeks before the entrapment, Charlie scaled Bernie's fence at the back of the lot. He'd stolen some generic 12-gauge wire. He stripped it throughout the night across the tracks behind the stands of willows. He'd made an even $75 the next day at Rudy's Metal. Bernie had recently bid on a demolition job. He used a rundown backhoe to knock down an old commercial building on the main street in Folsom, California. It was one of the mid-sized vintage buildings on Sutter Street. The former knick-knack shop had run out of owners. For years, the city of Folsom had eyed the place, and it had become an eyesore. Cities loved them some old-town retail food consumption garbage. Fats, Chinese dim sum, Scotch seafood, Lazy Dog Bar and Grill, even those damn Starbucks. Bernie had salvaged a few porcelain sinks and a toilet with a missing handle. It had run out of flushes. He hauled away two dump trucks worth of half-rusted away galvanized pipes and a variety of copper wire. A 5-year-old air conditioner looked brand new. A tingle had run up his leg. Bernie stacked most of the salvaged lumber on top of what he'd already collected in his chaotic yard next to the western wire fence. Christ, he'd found himself a newish washing machine and a bunch of hand tools that had been left in the building's basement. He intended to jack up their prices in his front office store. Best of all, he discovered him a bunch of number 10-gauge copper wire. It had been his best-kept secret when all the bidders inspected the place. He stripped it himself and rolled it into expensive magical coils of copper money. Charlie was flush, too, with cash from his prior week's copper sales, courtesy of stealing from Bernie. He and a few buds had spent Saturday night along the moonlit river. Sleeping bags and stars were all they needed. The four of them roasted wieners and drank a lot of Budweiser, traded bullcrap stories, and danced around the fire. "Now we're talking, baby. I'm all in. You better watch out, Charlie. We hear Bernie put up some remote cameras. That mean SOB is going to catch you in the act someday." "Jimmy, I'm a ghost. A junkyard's worst nightmare. Those two Germans, Goebbels and Himmler, they don't even bark at me anymore. Give free Cheetos to the United Nations. We won't have any more wars. It's like cracked dogs. Besides, bro, the two German shepherds think I'm part of the night crew." "Suit yourself, Charlie." The young man clanked Budweiser cans, spilling foam over the edges of the warm cans. They all shared this crazy Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer laughter, more beer and a special joy that only the homeless and truly free in life understand. At the time, it was late summer. Charlie and his crew had set up camp down along this creek that joined the Consumnes River. The creek's location was on the outer edge of the city of Rancho Cordova. Rancho Cordova was one of those newfangled cities in California that had reinvented itself. The Planning Commission had recently recommended that the city council adopt their recommendations. They needed to build a new city center. "Every damn city has a downtown," said the chief planner. The center would be built around an old train depot station and a pair of old railroad tracks that had quit going anywhere long ago, like much of America. Summer camping lasted as long as the good weather intended. Before winter, many homeless, including Charlie, would take shelter under a few of the local freeway overpasses. It was as cold as, well, hell, but at least you didn't get rained on. Everyone in the town knew that Charlie had staked out Bernie's junkyard dog recycling center years ago. Anyone who attempted to move into his territory risked a good ass whooping. All this had something to do about Charlie and what he'd learned as a small boy. All this territorial nonsense had become an odd way of getting to know his father. "Looky here, Charlie." Jeff Anderson drew Charlie in. He was good at that, a prerequisite for a sociopath. Charlie had only been 7 then. He bent his eyes over Jeff's right shoulder, keeping his distance. Jeff was Charlie's 3rd foster care dad. Jeff was a complete failure, a real knuckle-dragger. His parents had emphatically proven that what can occur when the premises of natural selection weren't followed. Jeff was born a genetic malfunction. He'd become a glitch in Charlie's used parts, mechanical world. He'd burned a perfect circle into Charlie's shoulder blade skin a few nights before. Not getting very close, Charlie couldn't peel his eyes off the computer screen. That's what you're going to look like if you live long enough, Charlie. Charlie backed up from the computer monitor, as if he might get infected. Somehow he knew the grisly, unshaven man in front of Barney's junkyard dog was indeed his biological father. He was a gruff-looking man with haunted eyes, maybe in his early 30s. At Barney's junkyard dog, we sell mostly wrecked car parts, but we also recycle a lot nobody wants. Barney practically shouted into the grainy camera. Jeff had found him on YouTube, too. It was as if Barney's voice, low voice, was stuck in first gear and his transmission of a brain was grinding away. He appeared cunning and ruthless. The local advertising clip was intended to reach potential customers in the vicinity of the new city of Rancho Cordova. Barney had a few catalytic converters on sale, legal and illegal. They both had been discounted. It's bedtime, Charlie. Get. Barney recycles. He doesn't want trash. He never wanted you either, Jeff uttered over his shoulder. Wrapped in a wicked briar patch of emotion, Charlie responded, Good night, Mr. Anderson. Amazingly, Charlie meant it. It was extremely difficult to anger Charlie, and he rarely held grudges. Good night then, Charlie. If that pathetic video doesn't get a response out of you, nothing will. You'd think a normal boy your age, who'd been tossed out like family garbage, would want to squash Bernie like one of those bloody-bellied Zika mosquitoes. Well, Mr. Anderson, not a whole lot of good ever comes from hating. Boy, get the hell out of here. Grow some balls. Everyone hates somebody. Love my boy Anderson. His mind is pure poison. And the bastard knows about hell. Charlie would never meet his biological father, at least officially. Barney would make sure of that.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Fall had been approaching. There was plenty enough time for camping and picking the sweetest blackberries this side of heaven, all down along the river. Charlie had been up and down the tracks a lot lately. With the increase in construction, summer had been good to him. The night's work would be easy. He'd climb the tall crosshatched galvanized fence at Bernie's junkyard dog recycling business many times before. Things had been going smooth all summer. Charlie felt pressing his luck wouldn't be a problem. After all, he'd gotten away with lifting a lot of Bernie's 12-gauge wire this past May and June. Charlie pressed his face tight up against the galvanized fence at Bernie's junkyard. He'd eyed the nearly 20-acre lot. Bernie's new cameras wouldn't be effective in capturing the ghost from his past. It'd be difficult to record Charlie as he floated through stacks of wrecked cars and recycling bins. Bernie had nearly outgrown his lot. He'd stacked and pinched together small cities worth of bashed cars and discarded household appliances. There were rows and rows of junk in his seemingly endless sea of iron. An abundance of used car parts had made Barney feel rich. He'd performed numerous demolitions and collected scores of T-boned auto accident metallic death carcasses all summer. He was the undisputed master of his own metal kingdom. Legal and illegal chop shop car parts had fluffed Barney's bottom line. Bernie's junkyard dog, Bernie, crushed on the name he gave his expanding business. After all, he had the heart and mind of a junkyard dog. In the moonlight, what stuck out to Charlie was the open trunk on the 2009 Honda Accord. It had been placed ass end nearly up against the fence. Just enough wiggle room to maneuver near the Honda's trunk had been allowed. The cramped space between the car and the fence was maybe a three-foot strip. The strip appeared to extend sideways along the entire fence, allowing just enough room for weeds to grow and a worker to maneuver. For some reason, the fractured Acura had been placed on the gravel path that separated two rows of stacked cars, rows 11 and 12. The Acura had an inch or two of daylight between the two rows, less than a coffin next to dirt. The Acura's front end, including its hood, having participated in a fatal head-on, had been driven through the windshield clear into the car's back seat. The car's frame had been bent, the doors had been frozen shut. Each row of flattened cars was stacked five high. Up front, near Sunrise Boulevard, was the sales area where Bernie conducted his sales promotions. Charlie climbed to the top of the fence. He paused. He read the topography of the junkyard. The front office and cameras were not in sight, but it didn't matter. Charlie positioned the small pocket flashlight in his mouth. Jesus! In the trunk of the car was a coiled strip of copper wire. The working trunk door had been left open by accident. Most of the wire had been covered by what looked like a burlap sack. Charlie knew it to be 6-gauge electrician wire. In fact, he had no doubt. He calculated the wire to be about 35 feet in length, or $200 at Rudy's Metal, no questions asked. Charlie's eyes evolved into slot machine wheels. His two cherries lined up. Before lowering himself over the fence, he made sure to toss Goebbels and Himmler their usual handful of Cheetos. Clump! Charlie's boots hit the ground. "Easy money, Bernie boy," he said in a jaded whisper. He calmed himself by petting his furry friends. While next to the two vicious watchdogs, Charlie absorbed all the affection he could handle. He'd save the rest of the Cheetos for when he'd exit the hellish junkyard cluster bang. In his head, Charlie was already purchasing beer and groceries for one last summer hoedown at the river's edge. There'd be plenty of cash left over to buy hot dogs and cigarettes down at the Shell Station overpass once the rainy days began. As he approached the Accord, the ground shook. The noise was deafening. As the dragon's tail snapped down the tracks like the crack of a whip, the wind knocked Charlie forward into the car's back bumper. Those damn boxcars had a mind of their own, he thought, all steel and rudder. Rancho Cordova was the kind of city where the trains move extra fast to get out of town. Some say that's part of the community's charm. Dry witchweed and thistles rattled Charlie's leather boots. Charlie gazed into the trunk of the black Accord. He perused the crime scene using the small flashlight again. This time he used his hand. It felt like a setup somehow. It seemed too good to be true. He raised his chin. He listened. The darkness was attempting to communicate. Charlie turned warning signs into dollar signs. Bernie wasn't that bright after all, Charlie thought. Charlie leaned in. He reached in and set aside the burlap sack that was partially covering the copper wire. Charlie was correct about the gauge of the wire. It was fat. But he'd miscalculated the length. It was double the original estimate. In the moonlight, Charlie rubbed the coil copper as if it was a totem. The warm breeze whipped at the back of his jacket, flipped up the collar. Charlie stood back and looked around again, down the rows and rows of stacked crushed cars. Nothing seemed out of place. He gave the Germans a few more Cheetos. After, Charlie stretched the upper half of himself like taffy. He'd nearly lowered his torso into the Honda's trunk. He attempted to grab the copper wire and lift it out. All of a sudden, the junkyard light snapped on. Concentration camp bright. As the two German shepherds dashed toward the front office, maybe 200 yards in the distance, Charlie eased himself into the back of a trunk and slowly closed it. Charlie paused, held his breath, and waited. He thought it exciting. After a good 10 minutes, Charlie heard the footfalls. They drew closer and closer, the next row of cars over. He knew it was Bernie. Bernie needed a hip replacement. The man stopped maybe 20 feet away from the Accord. Ever so stealthily, Charlie clinked the trunk down, locking it shut. Charlie's heart thumped 2 bongo drums. He wasn't going to allow any heartbeats to escape through the crack of the trunk. It felt strange, and then Charlie could smell the unmistakable acidity of black gunpowder before Bernie's 12-gauge shotgun blasted buckshot. Number 6 shot zinged through the galvanized fence in the direction of the willows across the tracks. Bernie was close enough that Charlie could smell his disgust. It grew silent again, maybe 20 minutes past, just the wind. Charlie, my blue-eyed boy, attempted to open the trunk. No dice. In a nanosecond, he discovered that the emergency latch was missing. He pressed his heels of his boots up against the haunted trunk door, careful to minimize any noise. Goebbels and Himmler whined, their high pitches of voice shrill and panicky. They sniffed at the trunk as if they wanted Charlie to come out. The yard lights went off. Silence. The wind picked up. The grass began to hiss, a song of anxiety and fear. A door opened at the back of the workshop. The two dogs greeted the sound with attention and waited. Silence. Charlie lay in a fetal position, still unafraid. He'd escaped from worse. Bitch, I've been in tougher situations. I'm still here, aren't I, Daddy-O? Charlie spoke softly, attempting to convince himself and Daddy-O. That sound. It was so damn strange. Nobody works on Saturday night, especially Bernie. Charlie's mind was a pressure cooker of thought. How would he ever escape? Charlie could hear something being pulled through a maze of graveled walkways. As the sound got closer, Charlie identified it as two welder tanks, clanking together as if they shifted to and fro, trapped to the welder's caddy. Charlie held his breath again. Get a grip, he thought to himself. Charlie wasn't familiar with the rusty pins and needles, feeling of panic. He felt a hot poker of electricity in every pore. Breathe in and out, slowly, Charlie repeated to himself. He was a Zen master, under control. The rolling noise stopped in the space 3 feet from the Honda's trunk lock. It was arranged and positioned. Charlie listened as the oxygen and acetylene valves opened up in order. He listened to the striker as it struck the flame. The righteous scent of acetylene, paired with pure oxygen, permeated the cooling air. Orange smoke pierced through the cracks in the car's trunk. Tips of welding rods created red-hot lines. As the welds cooled, they fused the trunk's door in place. After a few minutes, Charlie panicked and screamed. It had been difficult for him to beg for anything, but Charlie was begging for his life. Bernie, open the trunk, please, if that's you. I'm getting sick in here. Charlie kicked the door in a panic. Nothing. After the longest time, the flames fanned off like a F-16 jet's afterburners. Please, please, let me out! Charlie yelled at the top of his lungs. I'm claustrophobic! Charlie kicked in all directions. He turned into a madman. He spun around and kicked at the Honda's back seat frame. Nothing. Half of the Honda's weight had been pushed up against it, including the battered hood. Charlie kicked dents into the rear fender wells and the roof of the trunk, to no avail. Silence, after around 10 minutes, nearly voiceless, Charlie rested. He could tell when Bernie was coiling up the oxygen and acetylene hoses. After, he listened as Bernie wrapped the hoses tight around the valve stems of the tanks. The caddy had been tipped backwards. It was being pulled and rolling away again, this time back through the chunky gravel in the direction of Bernie's workshop. Once on the pavement, the welding caddy picked up speed. The rolling stopped. Charlie listened as the shop's heavy metal door was pounded to the ground, locking all the evilness inside. The next sound Charlie would hear wouldn't happen until daybreak. Day 2. Charlie removed all his clothing. The night had been cold, the day 10 times hotter. Early autumn in the Sacramento Valley can feel like late summer in hell. Charlie screamed and yelled and clawed at the metal. He made himself sick to his stomach. Charlie vomited. He was broiling under the Honda's black metal straitjacket. His knees and eyes were nearly swollen shut. His headache was a hammer striking an anvil. Day 3. It was late evening. Charlie woke. He listened. His friends were speaking to each other. He thanked God he'd never believed in. They'd been to town, his buddies, and they were trekking alongside the railroad tracks back to the river. Charlie's charm alone would have landed them a ride. Charlie beat and kicked at the car's trunk lid. It was still welded tight. He was a slab of rotting meat inside a private claustrophobic death chamber. Charlie's crew of four had paused. Something wasn't right. Before the diesel engine slammed past them all, they'd covered another 30 feet on the other side of the tracks. As the caboose whipped dust and fumes from the crushed rock and creosote beams they walked over, the young men moved out of hearing range along with the dust and wind. The last thing Charlie heard was a question from his friend Jimmy. Where the hell's our man Charlie? He better be having a damn good time. They'd miss him later that night, toast him with cheap wine. They would all be huddled around a new campfire that was growing more important every day. They'd pause and say how he'd never been so late to meet up with them. Day 4. Don't let them lie to you. Without water, life is short. Charlie had lost a deep well's worth of water while in Honda's incinerator. He'd passed out often. He'd also burned up a lot of calories. Nights were cold. He needed to keep warm. Death from the lack of water would feel natural, but was he really dying? Day 5. It was early morning. Charlie had been reduced to Play-Doh. He lay in a lumpy, naked pile and readied himself to get molded into what would be a perfect sculpture of imminent death. Barney used a forklift. Charlie hadn't been able to break the welds on the back seat's metal frame. Bernie lifted the engineless car. He backed it out from in between the two tall rows of crushed vehicles. Next, in reverse, he navigated the junkyard's maze of crushed vehicles and piles of recycled auto body parts. He drove across the length of the lot up to the inventory shed, where he stored most of his smaller used car parts. While idling in front of the car crusher, Bernie positioned the Accord. Bernie's perfect smile whored itself into a grimace. After the longest time, he trotted down the steps of the forklift. Bernie pressed the mighty crusher's auto-start button. It was hell green, the size of a bullet wound. The prehistoric iron-jawed behemoth began to chomp and grind. Bernie chuckled as he throttled the forks of the lift up to the beautiful fall sky. He paused. What a great day to die, he told himself. Next, he tilted the forklift blades downward. He gently shook the forks and lowered the wrecked car ever slowly into the jaws of the terrible iron beast. Not a sound could be heard as the black 2009 Titanic Accord went underwater. After the car had been crushed, Bernie removed it using his forklift again. He then carefully stacked it on the outbound pile of cars that had been scheduled for expedited pickup. Liquid oozed out of the broken radiator and onto the ground. He'd tossed the irreparable part of the back seat of the Honda the day he'd set the trap. The drippings were vicious, teal and red. The car had been emptied of wheels, doors, door locks, gearboxes, converters, and drivetrain. It had been reduced to the size of a coffin freezer. It all started as a mousetrap, an ass end of a practical joke, or so Charlie thought. Bernie got his wish. 3 straight chalk marks in the middle of the vintage chalkboard he'd hung right above his workbench. He'd gotten the old slate chalkboard at a garage sale. Go figure. Each white offering, a 3-inch straight line, had been placed on the old slate chalkboard. Bernie had nailed it to the wall after he'd snapped. I'll be goddamned if anyone is going to steal from me again, he said. The old chalkboard had taught a lot of lessons to dead 20th century kids. Make no mistake about it. Times had changed, but any lesson Charlie Tillman would ever learn in his life had been completed. The class was damn well near over. 3 years passed. Old Bernie continued to haul in cash. He was determined to get rich while cheating the government out of taxes. He'd been working late on a Saturday night. Bernie had promised his new family he'd be home hours ago. Home is where they were waiting with a few cold Costco pizzas. They were told more than once to never begin dinner until the provider got home. Bernie's young children knew how to follow orders. By God, he was going to finish installing the recycled Honda's gas tank, come hell or high water. It met factory specifications. Check. It was for a Honda Accord 3.5 V6. Check. It hadn't been safety tested, and Bernie could have cared less. Check. He'd recently seen one on eBay for $527.45. He'd removed his from that old 2009 Honda Accord wreck he'd set up a few years back. He'd already sold most of the parts of the wreck. What he had left were the gas tank and those sweet memories. He smiled as he wrenched in the last retainer bolt. Bernie was in a hurry. He'd cut corners. He'd been using two scissor jacks and a 4-inch by 6-inch wooden post to hold Elaine Remington's rear end up. He knew it was risky, but he'd done it before. He'd meet her obligation not because he was kind, but rather because she trusted his work. Trust was something you never gave Bernie. Bernie had thought of his cold Costco pizza and how much he'd scalp Elaine. There were only a few dents in the gas tank, but Bernie noticed a tiny speck at the bottom of the tank near the back strap. The dot appeared to be rusty. His mind attempted to convince him it was only a fly dropping. It shouldn't have been there. Bernie had power washed the tank, after all. He remembered using a rotary brush and buffer pad in an attempt to clean the rumpled thing. Bernie glanced up at his chalkboard. He smiled at the third chalk mark. He grinned as he recalled crushing the black Honda. The mechanic's light was stuck under the front wheel of the 2012 Accord. Bernie tugged at the yellow cord until he freed the greasy yellow tendon. He thought to hustle. He'd microwave the cold pizza. He'd slap the crap out of anyone who complained that he was late. His wife could play with their newborn. Control was something Bernie cherished. Bernie eyeballed the red speck. He needed more light. He tugged at the extension cord that had been snared by the cheap Harbor Freight scissor jack. He'd recently gotten two of them cheap. He'd broken the safer, expensive Craftsman 2 1/4-ton trolley jack. He determined that the red spot was actually a drip on the end of a drizzle. It had rolled over the top of the wrecked Honda gas tank and stuck there somehow. While on his back, Bernie used the heel of his boot to scoot his mechanic's creeper closer, clipping the second scissor jack with his foot heel. He smothered the droplet with light. It looked redder than rust. Dried blood, perhaps? Bernie's smile grew wide and grim. He recalled the noises Charlie made in the Hamel car shredder. He imagined the pitch and yaw of the black Honda as it twisted inside of the mouth of the massive beast. 5 family members had been killed in the wreck. Oh, how Bernie loved the sound that cars make when their axle bones, drivetrain vertebrae, and strut joints buckle and snap. The cheap jack stand next to Bernie's right shoulder collapsed. Still, Bernie, having steel balls the size of a truck hitch, pushed forward. By God, he'd finish the night by completing his project or die trying. He fancied the Jack Daniels bottle waiting for him at home in the tight cupboard. Bernie's iPhone alarm went off. "Give Me Shelter" by the Rolling Stones was his ringtone. As he reached for the phone in his overall hip pocket, he clipped the cheap jack stand again. Both jack stands collapsed away from the car body's frame, leaving only the wobbly wooden post. The shop lights clicked off. Bernie got disoriented. He attempted to sit straight up, smashing his forehead. In doing so, Bernie bumped the wooden beam holding up the back end of the Accord. The wooden beam collapsed. At first, Bernie squirmed like a rat in a trap. You would, too, if your diaphragm had been crushed. The exquisite pain was something he could stand. Bernie's inability to breathe was more of an issue. He wasn't able to scream. He felt claustrophobic all of a sudden. The lights clicked back on. As the car pressed closer to his face, his diaphragm slowly began to collapse. Bernie focused on the bloody spot that had caused all the havoc. There it was. It glinted in the brightness of his portable mechanic's work light. Bernie had thousands of thoughts after his breathing stopped. Bernie had hundreds of thoughts after his heart quit. Bernie last thought on the planet of Earth was how his reflection got into the tiny droplet of blood on the gas tank. He was confident. He cleaned the gas tank, raw and spotless. Lung mist coats everything. I don't usually involve myself with pedestrian crap like this, but you know what? I really like Charlie. I hope you enjoyed Stealing Love by author Dan Cardoza, as performed by yours truly. If you've enjoyed the tales you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author can be found by visiting our website. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Cardoza. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/CARDOZA. Whether you've come for the horror or his other works of fiction or nonfiction, he certainly enjoys delving into how the mind can be a terrible thing to waste. As a reminder, if you decide to give any of this talented author's stories a read, please consider leaving them a quality review and a kind word, or a thoughtful public comment and an upvote, and be sure to let them know that you heard about them on this program and that me, Otis Gyres, sent you. It means more to me than you can imagine, and I'm sure Dan would much appreciate it also. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring Twice the Terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyres channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014, and you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too, as well as my Patreon page. Just search for Otis Gyres. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyres. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyres channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at Otis at simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's O-T-I-S at simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.